and you know, we were lucky as Jukebox to always kind of like have a real big crew of like friends who would come along, and then people who like kind of became fans or friends through that, and just a big drinking crew because everybody was in their early 20s. So like we'd play places and like, you know, even if there was only like 50 people there, 50 people drank like they were like 250 people. So the venues always wanted you back. And some of these places couldn't even hold more than 50 people anyway.
Mike Terry, welcome to the Question the Answers podcast. How you doing, sir?
Hey, what's going on? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, buddy. Man, it's good to see you. Some congratulations are in order. I mean, I know that you just formally announced it. We're pregnant.
Yes, we are pregnant. It's super crazy. I mean, we're one of the you know, I can check off a couple of quarantine list items, as in like your punk rock friend who got into real estate and like changed their job from like being like a live music venue person to being a real estate person. And then I also got engaged and got pregnant. So I'm hitting the bingo soon.
Yeah, well, and are you're looking for a house too, right?
So like I'm doing real estate myself, but also looking to move. It's a terrible, terrible idea for all these things are terrible. I mean, they're all wonderful things, but they're all
Well, sure.
terrible things at once.
Yeah, I mean, those are like, I guess, like good problems to have, but I mean, I don't know, to quote Blake, like, I don't know, you're not punk, man. I'm telling everyone, but no, anyway. That was a bad jawbreaker joke. Anyway, no, Mike Terry, like, dude, it's great to see you. I mean, you're an awesome dude. I always love running into you. I always love chatting with you. It's great to have you on the podcast. Anyone who doesn't know, so Mike Terry is a member of the Jukebox Romantics, who are kind of a pop punk band out of like the New York area. Been around for a little over a decade now, right?
Yeah, it's August 2008 is when we started the band.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so 13 years. Okay, sweet.
Fuck.
I mean, that's a good tenure for any band. And yeah, I mean, you've made the rounds. I mean, you've done a lot of touring. You've toured over in Europe. You've put out a few full lengths, a couple of EPs. And I know that you've got some stuff brewing for the not too distant future, which you know, we can chat about in a little bit. But yeah, man, you know, I wanted to bring you on here because I know you have some great stories to tell, and I think it'd be awesome to kind of introduce you to anyone who doesn't know about the Jukebox Romantics and talk about, you know, your experiences with that. So first and foremost, tell me about the Jukebox Romantics. Like, so where did you guys start, and you know, how did that all blossom, and how it's been going?
Sure. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for having me. And then, yes. So we started in 2008. It was a phone call to my friend Seth and Mike Stratton, and I believe Joe. They were in a band called Johnny Giovanni and the Zombie Pit Group, and they were like the best like local band where we lived. They were like a ska punk band that was just so good. And like they were one of those bands that, you know, like they were like, if any band was going to make it from where we were, like this was the band that was going to blow up like and get known in the punk scene. And they just didn't really have like the person behind them to like run that machine. Like they were just like, you know, four dudes who like wrote awesome songs, but there was no one like holding the reins for them. And you know, they went to college, and you know, a lot of bands break up during that time. And what happened was, is I had just finished being in a band, and I was looking to be like in a serious band. Like everybody I'd been playing with was like a drunk and this and that. And I was like 20, I think it was like 19 or 20. And I was like, I'm looking to play with like dudes who want to like have goals and just tour, like make friends, travel the world, you know, and if it can pay for itself, then like it's totally a success. Like never, you know, like we had like, you know, goals in mind, short-term and long-term goals, but we had them from the beginning. But the idea was always to tour and like grow the band just naturally. And I hit those dudes up. I was like, I love your band. Your band is my favorite band. And I was like, I always wanted to be in your band, but you never needed a third guitar player. And so pretty much we Jukebox Romantics started as me and three guys from that band, minus their singer, who's like a dear friend of ours and the drummer's brother. He was going into acting and just super busy with that. And actually, I'm in a side band with him right now that we started during the pandemic. And then this kid, Chris, who I was going to college with, who was like in like a 29 piece ska band with members of like, I guess like We Are the Union and all those ska bands that exist now from Long Island. And that's kind of how the band started. We started in that summer. We were playing like a bunch of covers, and like literally at like the second practice, we're like, we need to find a singer. I knew Chris, and we made goals like right away. We made a demo within the fall, and then we had a full length by like that following spring of 2009. And then we toured. Like the idea was just to tour and get our name out there, because MySpace was still a thing, but we weren't really into the whole internet thing. We were already like old heads in our brains at like 20 to 25 was the age group. And we're like, let's just go on the road. Like nobody's touring, nobody's just doing it. So we DIY booked everything, and we toured for like 280 days, like the first year of being a band, like the first year, like 200 to 300 days for like the first 3 years, like off and on, like go out for 2 weeks, come back, go out for a month, come back. And that's kind of how we kind of build up a name really quick within like a year or two.
That's nuts. I mean, for any band of any scale, like that's a lot of touring.
Yeah, it was fucking crazy. And I think we just did it because we were like, we were all really hungry to do it. And it was at a point where it wasn't just one person doing like, you know, so every band's got like one or two people that kind of like do everything until you get like maybe a booking agent or somebody else to help you with stuff. But we were all like, everybody was in, like there was five of us, and all five people had like a job to do in the band and did their job for like the first couple years, 2 or 3 years. It was like pretty intense. And I had never been in a situation like that. And it was exactly kind of like what we set out to do. It was like, let's just do it and have fun and make friends and travel and try to get on bigger things and do cool shit. Like the idea was, let's just keep doing cool shit and just play a lot. And, you know, we did some cool shit. We did some stupid shit. Fucking, it was just fun. We just traveled and toured a lot and broke down a lot. And we had noticed that there was only a few other bands kind of doing it at the time. And it kind of got us noticed. And now everybody tours like that, or at least did until the before times. At the time, though, in like 2009, it wasn't like that as much. It wasn't like everybody was just hitting the road. I think we were still booking stuff through like Book Your Own Fucking Life, like doing it that way. And it's changed over the years a little bit, but that's kind of how the beginning of it started, with just hitting the road and kind of getting a name for just hitting the road. Like, oh, they're that band that just tours all the time. But no one knew who we were or what we sounded like. But it was like, oh, I know that name. Like, you guys are on the road all the time. I'm like, yeah, I guess it's cool to know, be known as that.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I know of a few bands that were kind of notorious for like that marathon style touring where they like essentially just lived on the road, and they were
some kind of nightmare. It was one of them that still does, or that we kind of met them along the way. And When Particles Collide, like a lot of these people were people that just kind of left their houses and like stayed in a van or like turned into like a mobile thing or like. And lived on the road. We definitely always just came back home. We were too poor to do that. And like everybody had kind of real jobs, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was in regard to, you know, so you guys are from the East Coast, and I'm, you know, a West Coast kid, and I, you know, grew up in the Northern California area. I grew up in a particularly small town in rural California. Can you say rural? Rural?
But, yeah, rural.
Rural.
Don't ask me to say drawer.
Yeah, rural drawer.
Rural drawer.
Anyway, no, so I'm from like a small town in Northern California, and it was always an interesting kind of dynamic, like trying to think of how different scenes were, you know. And you know, one of the things that I always thought was really fascinating about like the East Coast versus the West Coast is that, I mean, just, you know, you could literally drive 2 hours and be in two different states, you know, and you kind of have these little pocket scenes within each one of those little states. And like in a place like California, it kind of works that way, but not always that way, in that, like I could be on like the east side of Northern California and have my little scene here. And then there's like the East Bay punk scene, which is kind of connected still, but so the separation isn't as, I think, distinct. Would you say that that's the case in the East Coast? I mean, I may have like made that up in my head, just having not really experienced it. I was always curious to know, is that kind of how it was?
It's definitely always been that way. I think that the only real difference between the West and the East in that sense is that I think that because the drives are shorter over here on the Northeast, specifically on the Northeast shorter, it makes you a little bit more close knit. However, there was 100%, like I live and our band started right outside of New York City. So like just north of the Bronx and kind of technically Long Island, because two of us were living out there in the beginning. And now we're just all like in the Yonkers area, which is just above the Bronx. I mean, everybody knows Yonkers. And Norm lives like another hour north by Poughkeepsie, which is like a famous music town. The scenes outside the city always bled into the city because everybody wanted to play New York City. And then somewhere between like 2000, it's like 15, 16, the city morphed into like everybody just plays Brooklyn now, which kind of sucks because for us, it's like a longer drive. Not much, but still like 45 minutes without traffic. But I had this talk in 2013 with Johnny Madcap and Justin from The Distractions and Original Son. And they had flown out here to do a tour with us and the Scandals from New Jersey. And it was a dumb tour to decide to tour in the middle of February in a blizzard that dropped while they landed in New York. And I picked them up at the airport and basically in a 2-week tour, the first like 6 or 7 days were already canceled when they landed, because it was just like the snowstorm was following the tour. Mm. And, but we had talked in that downtime when we weren't playing shows about how, what Johnny realized when they were touring with the Bouncing Souls and Madcap in the early 2000s in New York, and touring even with us, you know, a decade later, that on the East Coast, the communication is a lot better. Mm. It might not be that like things are that much tight knit or smaller. I think just the way people talk to each other out here and doesn't have that malaise of that LA haze over it. whereas the Bay Area is the most close thing. A Bay Area, like Sacramento vibe when it comes to, of California specifically, mm-hmm. to like the way communication works in New York would probably be the closest to it, because that LA punk thing is a completely different vibe. And I think it bleeds over from the whole Hollywood vibe of like mm-hmm. people using you and not really wanting to be genuine with what they're trying to do. Like, you know, no, people aren't really trying to help each other up as much. It's more like stepping over each other by using somebody. Whereas okay. here in New York, it's very much like we're in this together. And that's always like a New York thing. And maybe it's like a deep seated New York thing or like a post 9/11 thing, but like, it's like a, just a little bit more brotherly love. Like this is more about unity and helping each other. And if we can both help each other in a situation, that's great. Instead of like, hey, I'm just being fake because I want to use you to like bring my band to this show or level or this connection. And I think that is a huge difference when it comes to the communication of the two. Mm-hmm. But the scenes in general, to go back to like kind of the beginning of that, was like the scenes are still separate. I mean, we have a thing called Punk Island here every year, which is all of the punk scene in New York coming together and playing on like an island, Governor's Island or Randall's Island. And it's all like the different promoters. And it's clear that there's like the crust punks and the street punks and the pop punks and all these bands that know each other, but don't know each other. And it's such separate scenes, but it comes together one time a year. So I think that exists kind of everywhere, especially in a bigger city area like California or New York, you're going to have that.
Sure. And yeah, I mean, just by virtue of the way that the lines are drawn on the map, right? I mean, you've got a state like New Jersey and you've got Pennsylvania and then you've got New York and you've got Massachusetts, which are four very prime, you know, examples of places where there's a ton of culture in each one of those states. And each one has its own very unique scene. And sure. many great bands have come out of those unique scenes.
In and out of those scenes, major cities as well, because each of those states have pockets of scenes within the states. There's Philadelphia, but then there's the York, Harrisburg area. And then, you know, they all have that. It's interesting. I guess it depends on where you live and your scene and like what you consider it. You know, I think this is a problem that we have as like major city people. I don't think in the Midwest, it's the same thing, unless it's a bigger city.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think if you were to ask bands from like, say, you know, Chicago or St. Louis or, you know, Indianapolis or something like that, like they might have like a completely different answer, you know, than our perception, like what we make up in our own
brain. Oh yeah. Like, I mean, I remember the first tour I ever did, not in Jukebox, was with a band called 42 Grams of Heart Attack. And we played Joliet, Illinois, but to us, it was, we were playing Chicago. And I don't think that's Chicago at all. I think it's like, I think it might be like 20 minutes out.
Right. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, like you see that happen all the time. Like, actually, I remember there being like a lot of kind of, it ruffled some feathers because I saw this one show in Oakland and the band came out. They're like, "Hello, San Francisco." And everyone's
oh,
like,
"Oh, no."
Really, dude?
Like, I mean, that definitely happened on some Warped Tours around. I think the first year on Warped Tour, it was all West Coast states besides like a little bit of the Midwest. And there was definitely some cities where, like, I remember being in, I'm like, I don't know where in California we are, but I know we're not in San Diego. Like, this is, I know, like, this is Chula Vista, but I think that's San Diego, but I wasn't sure. So I didn't know what to say on stage. So I definitely just didn't say anything. I was like, "Hey, what's up?"
"Hello, San."
"Hey, California." It's like, "Hey, California, we're here for the next week. So I'm just going to say, hey, California."
Right. But yeah, tell me a little bit about the scene kind of growing up. Cause I mean, I remember hearing these stories about like, you know, bands from like Long Island and like Coney Island High and like these kind of famed like venues out there. Like, I mean, what was the scene like when you were kind of coming up?
When I was coming up, there was a lot more clubs around that was doing shows and a lot more DIY spaces that were like churches and basements and punk houses and teen centers, a lot of teen centers, VFW halls. And this was like early 2000s to age myself. I'm 35. So this is like 2001 to 2004, like in my first couple bands growing up and seeing the scene. It was very much not like we would go to New York City for the big shows. And then like, cause nobody big played up here. There was a place called 7 Willow Street in a town called Portchester, which is right at the border of Connecticut and New York. That place had like huge punk shows all the time, but I think we were too young. And since we didn't drive, I think we just didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. The internet was like a thing, but we just didn't know. We only knew about like what was happening, like in the big city venues, like Irving Plaza and Roseland. And then, you know, cause that's how you found out about smaller bands. When I was young, like you went to go see a bigger band. You're like, "Oh, there's a smaller band opening up." And then that's how we found out about the smaller scenes. And let's see, there was ABC No Rio, which is still around, or I think it might be closed right now for like building out a new space, but that was all ages. And the old Knitting Factory, just a lot of random places, talking CBGBs. Right. I remember playing CBGBs on a Monday night and like, it was the coolest thing the first time. And then after like the 20th time, like CBGBs is one of those places that we totally missed out on. Like we were like, you know, that's one of those the places it was like, Rancid played there in like the 2000s and shot the Red Hot Moon video there. And it was fucking awesome. And there was like a lot of cool things that would happen there. But as a small band, like the scene really didn't go check out small bands there from what I remember. I remember like park shows and apartment shows and like DIY space shows being like way more of a thing. And like CBGB's was like, CB's kind of sucks. Like, you know, like it was awesome. And I wish it never closed. It should be a fucking historical site. Right. But I remember that being like a place and just a lot of churches, and Long Island was a whole different beast. Like when I first started driving at 16, we were taking our bands like out of town, like going to Long Island was like going on tour because it was like an hour and a half away to get to like where like the parts of Queens and Long Island met, because it's all the same islands, Queens, Brooklyn, and Long Island's all the same strip of land.
Right.
And like the scene out there was just insane. Like the Long Island scene to this day, even though people out there will be like, "The scene sucks out here, it's dead," there are more music venues and bands per capita than I think anywhere outside. And it's not even like a college town. There's colleges out there, but there are bands of all levels and ages and genres out there. People just love music out there. And there's a ton of venues and bars to play at. And as much as people might say it stinks at times, like it's always pretty good and been good to us. It's just, you know what it is? Everything's just deep. Everything's a drive out there. It's a long drive, tolls. It just seems like it's like, oh, we're playing local. It's like a local show, but it's still like 2 hours away. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, in regards to that, so like for instance, if you're going from like say, you know, the Upper Bronx or like just outside of the Bronx,
you have to go over a bridge to Long Island, and then you have to backtrack to get off the island.
No, totally. Like when you look at it geographically, like it doesn't look like it's that far, but like you said, it's like you're going through the city, you're going through, and then there's toll roads and
so much traffic.
All the New York traffic. But like, I wanted to ask you, so being a New York band, who lives in essentially New York City.
Yeah, like the metropolitan area. Yeah.
You know, the metropolitan area, which I'm sure this is similar to the way it's handled or maybe considered in LA, right?
Yeah. Because
LA is like this large conglomerate of smaller towns, like smaller boroughs, like whatever. Was there a lot of pressure for the bands to do a lot of that heavy lifting for like promotion on your own? If you were like, say you're playing a show in Long Island, right? Which is like basically an hour and a half away.
Yeah.
But you're technically from New York still.
Yeah. So there was like a lot of like, it depends on where you play. There was I feel like in early on jukebox days, there was a lot of pay to play things. And we got roped into some of it and out of it really quickly, and because everybody started turning against it. So that started stopping. But it was a lot of this, like, you know, if you brought people, and, you know, we were lucky as jukebox to always kind of like have a real big crew of like friends who would come along, and then people who like kind of became fans or friends through that, and just a big drinking crew because everybody was in their early 20s. So like we'd play places and like, you know, even if there was only like 50 people there, 50 people drank like they were like 250 people. So the venues always wanted you back. And some of these places couldn't even hold more than 50 people anyway. Mm-hmm. So then when we started like getting asked to play bigger shows or do other things because we had a draw, you know, it kind of looked weird to a lot of New York City bands because we'd be like the local support in Brooklyn for like a bigger show. And we're not even from there, you know, like we're from like an hour away. So and people would be like, how are you getting on these shows? It's like the local support. And like, I don't know, people come and we, you know, we live relatively in distance. And the funny thing you'll learn about New York City is that people from outside the city, like parts of New Jersey and Long Island and where we live in Westchester County, will travel into the city and drive all the way to Brooklyn to see a band that they like. But people who live in those areas are not jaded, but like, they're like, oh, I'm not taking that train across the city. You know, there's like, it's like, it's one of those things like, oh, take a subway to Brooklyn from like lower Manhattan. It might
take, crazy?
Yeah, it might take a half an hour, but like, so that's a thing. It's like kind of, and it's funny because a lot of these venues also have, you know, radius clauses. And when you're a young band, like you're like, you want to play every weekend everywhere as much as possible. And so you couldn't, you know, if you played in Manhattan one weekend, it's like, all right, well, you can't play in Brooklyn for another 2 months.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's
even though it's completely different worlds, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I think is like such a double-edged sword, because like when you have a place like New York or like say LA, for a lot of bands, and this is a really important lesson, I think, that especially when you're younger, is tough to really learn as a good thing, is that sometimes when you play that much, you're doing yourself a huge disservice.
Definitely. I mean, that was why we left. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was part of the reason why we left. There was nowhere else to play. We had played everywhere around here very quickly. We're like, you know, and that part of our goal was to leave. So I know what you're about to say, but yeah, go for it.
Well, yeah. I was just going to say, like, it's the whole radius clause thing can really be to your benefit if you acknowledge why it's valuable, you know,
because, it's a very important thing.
Yeah. Like, you know, as a club owner, you know, it's valuable to them to ensure that every time a band plays that they can maximize their drawing potential.
Sure.
And bands kind of, I mean, it's not so, I think it's less of an ego thing and just more of like an enthusiasm thing, that they think it's like, oh, like we're going to play and like people are going to come and they're going to come. It's going to be fun. It's like, dude, guess what, dude? People are going to stop coming at a certain point. You know, they're just going to be like, yeah, I'll catch them next time. Cause you always play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But no, I think it's great that you guys managed to get out on the road so much, which is really, I think, what did like benefit you the most, is like getting your name out there and like casting a much wider net.
Yeah. I think, you know, early on we had hooked up with Altercation Records, and they were a small but growing label at the time based out of Kingston, New York and Austin, Texas. There's two owners, Travis Myers and JT Haversat. JT does comedy. He's always on the comedy circuit and does festivals and stuff. And, you know, they had a great mindset of like, oh, like if you're touring in the first like 2 years, if you're touring like your region, everybody on your region or coast should maybe your name should be familiar to them. After 5 years, if you're touring like your region and like the Midwest, then your name should kind of be familiar. Within 10 years, you know, unless you're doing something wrong, you know, everybody should have maybe heard of you to an extent. And I thought that was like a really great thing at the time, before like the oversaturation of people touring, which I think it's great. I love that everybody, that there's a million bands out there, because it's awesome. And I thought that was a really great idea of like, oh yeah, that's really smart. And I think going back to what we were talking about earlier, especially in the Northeast, I think it's very important. And I think it's something that I think we jumped the gun on, but like bands should start, if you want to leave your area, just go within like an hour outside and go north, west, south, or then you can do a whole 3 week tour in two or three states and not play to the same people and not have to put all that miles in your car. I think it's just exciting to travel outside of places you've never been to. And that's why we all do it. And like, you know, and there's different markets and scenes, but I think when you're starting a band, if you're going to tour, I think it's very important to just start in your area and then reach out into your region and then go out, you know, unless you're like gaining traction really fast, like, wouldn't it just make sense to build outward from where you are instead of being like, all right, we're from New York, let's just drive all the way to California, play some shows and drive back, which I know tons of bands who have done that from New York. They drove out to California, played like five shows on the way out there, which is not a lot to get all the way out there, and then play out there, like all up and down the coast, all the way to fucking Washington and back down. And then all the money, if they did make money, they would drive all the way back because everybody had to get back because it takes, you were already gone for 2 weeks. And you burned all the money you made, which is just insane. But like, I think there's just smarter ways of doing it. And I'm not saying we were smart and did it that way. I'm just saying, like, thinking back on it now, like if anytime I meet like a young band, they're like, oh, we want a tour. Like, what should we do? I'm like, just like fucking do it. Number one, just do it. Don't just, and book it and talk to people, because there's so many like places, so many things you can do wrong, you know, playing the right places, you know, knowing, you know, just asking for help is not a bad thing. Some people are afraid to ask. And then, you know, like, don't go so far. You don't have to go all the way to, you know, the other side of the fucking world, because America is a big place.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot that can be said to going somewhere far for the sake of traveling and then doing the music thing kind of as a secondary piece of that, you know? So, you know, like if you're in a band and like if the band all wants to go and hang out on the West Coast, if you're
from definitely.
You know, and you can kind of kill two birds with one stone. But I think that that's kind of a matter of just making your mindset be, okay, the music part is kind of the secondary thing. Like, you know, it's important that we do a good job and it's important that we play our best, but we're more concerned about maybe traveling.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I didn't take a vacation for the first like, you know, 8-9 years of this band, because going on tour was like visiting places, you know. It wasn't vacation, but like I got to travel, you know, and we planned it that way, you know.
Well, right. And you know, I think anyone that has done any touring like understands that, you know, even when you are on the road and you're seeing these different towns, like oftentimes you're only there for a couple of hours, really, in terms of how many hours you actually have with time to kill, you know?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times you're finding parking, you're unloading, you're reloading, you're doing sound check, and then you're getting ready for the show, and then you're playing the show, and then you're loading out, and then you're hanging around, and then you're trying to find a place to sleep, and then all of a sudden you're gone.
And then you missed it's funny you say that, because like I got a great example of that. Five times it took for me to like Houston, Texas. Don't tell our good friend Charlie Price about this, but I hated Houston, Texas. The first time I went there was right before we started the band. The band was like a year old. And I went out to WrestleMania in Houston, Texas. And it was in downtown Houston, which reminds me of very much like White Plains, New York over here. But there was nothing there. So like office buildings. And then the second time we went was for a Warped Tour, and it rained, and it was a parking lot in Warped Tour. And then like we played Rudyard's or a couple other places. We played some places out there, but we never saw anything. I was just like, this town's a shithole. And it's kind of like, whatever. Like, we're like, I don't know. Like, I don't like it here. Like every time it's just so bad vibes. And then one day we played, and it was like a cool area. And then we got taken around because we had some time finally to kill. I think we had like a day off and we just happened to be in Houston. I was like, oh, great, a day off in Houston. But then we met some, you know, we knew, you know, Jason and Charlie, and somebody took us around and we're like, oh, you know what? This is a pretty cool town. But it took five times to figure that out. You know, it's like, there's not always time to really see what you want to see or to really get the feel of a city at all, you know?
Right. Well, and I think that if you are a band that tours a lot, you know, you start to build those connections and then you kind of plant some roots, you know, because of the, and then it becomes a little easier for you to find the time and kind of figure out like, I mean, I know bands that purposefully, whenever they tour, and they're particularly going to places that they do have some roots, they'll purposefully plan for their days off, you know, so that they can spend time there and like actually get to see like these places. Like, you know, I know that like on the West Coast, like Portland and Seattle are like two of the big hotbeds for that. Obviously the Bay Area is, you know, you know, whatever, but, you know, it's funny that you mentioned WrestleMania, cause that's something that I wanted to ask you about. So you're a big wrestling fan.
Super.
Yeah. Like, so when did you get into wrestling? I mean, I'm 42. I'm a little bit older than you. I got into wrestling very aggressively. Like in the early 80s, like the mid 80s.
I don't remember how. I just remember that I had a Jake the Snake Roberts toy that his arm went back and it pushed forward. And I thought he was cool because he had a snake and he did the DDT. And I remember watching it at my grandfather's house, and I had to be like five. And I remember watching it like on ESPN, but it might've been like AWA wrestling and not even WWF. And then just like, you know, I think we're very much like a nostalgia generation. And I remember going to the video store all the time and always just start, once I got into wrestling, I just remember renting wrestling VHSs all the time because that was like a huge thing. And so that's how I got into it. I don't remember who got me into it or how I saw it. I think how I originally saw it was at my grandfather's house, and I was a big American Gladiators fan. And American Gladiators was on like Saturdays at like 11 a.m. Here in New York, and then on Fox 5. And then after Gladiators would end, the WWF Superstars would start. And it was like a 1-hour show, and like it was a bunch of squash matches with like whoever. And like Hulk Hogan would always cut a promo or The Undertaker, but nobody would ever have a match. You had to like wait for the pay-per-view or something. I don't think Monday Night Raw was a thing yet. And it was because of American Gladiators, and then the role, the lead into the WWF Superstars.
I absolutely loved and lived wrestling, like professional wrestling. When I was,
you know, what's weird about it too is because I got really into music then, like you did too, and like all of us, you know, people who are listening to this who are into music, and it was weird. I don't know where I realized it. Sometime in like 2012 or 11 or 13, we were writing for a new record, and we were stoked because Pete from the Bouncing Souls was going to produce it, and he did. And I had watched a documentary, and it was about like some pretty big famous wrestler, but he was who was big like in all around the world, but he never was in WWF or WWE, and he was talking about like traveling around and being in a van with like other wrestlers and going from show to show and sleeping on people's floors and couches. I was like, this is the same exact lifestyle. Like the duality of the both of them is like, you're doing your art and you're traveling and you don't really get to see anywhere. You see basically like the parking lot, you load in, you do the show, you might be going to get some food, and then you fucking sleep and go to the next place. And I was like, whoa, like, two things that I love in my life a lot, which is pro wrestling and music, the lifestyles of the entertainers and people who do it, the artists, is like very much the same. And comedians, it's the same way, but I guess I didn't have a love for comedy the same way. And comedians, it's probably worse because it's way more solo and alone and a little bit, but I just thought it was crazy because there are two things I love, and like they have very similar lifestyles. And then, you know, meeting some pro wrestlers and becoming friendly with them, like, and who are also into punk, it's like, oh, you are like my favorite human, like, because like you know the struggle on like a different end of things, and you, there's a passion and love for something that doesn't other people don't understand, because there's other art forms out there that don't involve, like, you know, and it depends what type of band you're in and how much you travel, but like there's that like that like desire and need to go do that and work ethic and all that sort of stuff. It's this passion. It's cool to see that in like a completely different thing, but exactly same lifestyle, healthy or not. I'm sure most pro wrestlers are, a lot of them are probably healthier than all band members, but in a different way.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on what lens you're looking through. Cause I know that like some of the wrestling documentaries that I've watched, like those guys do some crazy stuff to their bodies and like,
oh yeah,
you know, constantly on, I mean, you know,
uppers and downers and all
that
stuff
out here or anything like that. But cause I have nothing but respect for people that do that. Cause dude,
it's self-medicating like anything else. Like,
the sheer amount of like damage they do to their bodies is just nuts, dude. Like
it's like a car crash every day.
Yeah.
And dude, think about what's his name right now. He's killing it in both fields. Andy Williams from Every Time I Die. He's in AEW, which is a huge wrestling promotion on TNT every week. Like that dude's playing music and a pro wrestler, like a legit one, like on TV, like not a legit one, but like famous known thing. Like that's crazy. That's like, what's his name from Pulley? Wasn't he like a baseball player? Oh, also?
Scott Radinsky.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? Somebody who has like two so different careers, but wrestling is exactly the same as music. It's, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, and with the wrestling thing too, I mean, I know that at Fest they do their wrestling. And I can't remember if it's a specific promotion.
Yeah. It's Fest Wrestling.
It's like just Fest Wrestling. Okay.
Yeah. So they do it year round when Fest isn't happening.
Right. Okay. Right. Got it. But Jukebox has been there and actually performed during that, right?
Yeah. We performed at Fest Wrestling a few years ago now.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. We have something here on the West Coast, similar to that. It's they do it in Oakland and it's called Hood Slam.
Oh, Hood Slam is the shit.
Yeah, Hood Slam. Have you been?
No, but do bands play at Hood Slam?
Yes, they do.
Okay, because I've seen Hood Slam videos on YouTube. I didn't know that bands play it, but I also know that Hood Slam is fucking ridiculous.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It's like over the top wrestling. It's
way
like so
over the top. Yeah. It's everything that wrestling kind of needs to be, because it's like that perfect blend of shtick and, you know, comedy and kind of rock and roll and like, and like a little bit of danger.
Yeah.
And they kind of take it up a notch because it's, you know, it could,
it's definitely like rated like TV MA wrestling, right? Is it like pretty, like,
yeah. So it's definitely not for like little children, you know,
but, right. Yeah.
But I mean, wrestling these days, it kind of like professional wrestling these days, it seems, is definitely not catered towards little kids, you know, like it was in like the '80s, like the '80s was definitely like much more like cartoonish, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, but that still exists too. It just, it depends on what you're looking for and where you're looking. But yeah, Hood Slam's crazy from what I've seen and what I've heard. Like, I've never gone to that. I also know in Reseda, there's a huge wrestling thing that's like, what's it called? PWG. Okay. And they do it like out of a VFW hall, and it's like sells out every time, and there's like celebrities there for some reason. Mm. But it's like super like DIY vibes. Yeah, there's a lot of weird wrestling. Lucha Vavoom is out by you guys, I think.
Mm. Okay.
It's like burlesque and pro wrestling and like sideshow performers. It definitely has like a hipstery vibe to it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, shifting gears back to music real quick.
So
I know that there's not a ton of details yet, but we're going to be hearing some new Jukebox stuff coming out probably sometime this year, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. So we have a new EP. We recorded with John Nicolario. Because of the pandemic, it took way longer than expected. And in that whole time we had like a lineup shift where we added two band members, two amazing, amazing, awesome humans. Who are in awesome bands, AJ Chiarella from the band Shakeout, and James Mackey, baby. And he plays in a band called Maintenance. Hmm. And they're two local dudes and they're in awesome bands, and their energy and vibe is so good. And they've joined the band. So now we're a four piece again, which is awesome. Cause that means I can do the Tim Armstrong thing and just not play guitar. Okay. And just run around and sing. But it's exciting. We have that, the EP, and we're working on artwork right now with Michaela Jane, who is awesome. And just started talking to a music video guy for some music video stuff and new band promos. You know, like everyone in our band is vaccinated now, which is fucking awesome. So, and that's really cool. So get vaccinated, anybody listening, so we can go back to doing music stuff and easily. That's not a thing. That's not a word. But yeah, so new music soon. Hopefully it's done. We're stoked on it. And it's really exciting because it's like something that like we're fucking stoked on. And it's just because the pandemic, it kind of just took a little bit longer. And then we have already like another like 5 or 6 songs written for the next thing, like kind of in the pipe, which is cool. Cause like it's all happening really like quickly in the last few months with adding the new guys. They've learned like 20 old songs plus the 5 new ones in a few months. And that's pretty great with a pandemic and everything going on,
right?
And doing it safely. So it's exciting stuff. And yeah, that should be out hopefully soon. And down the pike, and it'll, you know, we'll let you know, everybody will know. And we're excited. Hopefully it'll be out before Fest. Cause that's the next thing we kind of have on the books. We have Fest for this fall. So, there's still tickets available for Fest. There's like not a lot left at the time we're recording this. So get your Fest tickets, but get vaccinated and get your Fest tickets to keep everybody safe. And then we have Booze Cruise in Germany, but I just don't think it's going to happen. I just don't think we'd be allowed to go.
Yeah. You know, my guest this week, which I guess was a few weeks ago for people listening now, but was our booking agent, Katy Perry. And, you know, we were talking about some of the issues going for people trying to travel internationally for music, and how they've just, the visa process has just gotten exponentially harder, you know, so on both sides of the aisle. So it's going to be interesting to see like who's able to do what. Cause even bands at like a high level have huge barriers to get in.
And yeah, I have a buddy who does monitors for Metallica and for John Mayer. And he was telling me about like how they're trying to do stuff, but because the crews are so large for those productions, it's like a whole logistical nightmare. Not like those things are already not a logistical nightmare for tours that are that big, you know, but now on top of it, it's like, just add like a bunch of more paperwork on top of it.
Yeah. You know? It's gotta be so much harder. Well, I'm not saying it's going to be so much harder, you know, blah, that's,
we'll all figure
probably
it out.
Not, I mean, that's not what I meant to say. I think in terms of trying to do it the way that the bands want to do it, you know, and bringing their own crew in to do things the way that they want to do it versus having to perhaps hire like a local crew and then have all of their stage stuff built there and like have it all made there. I mean, that's got to be an undertaking that I think a lot of bands, like say the Metallica level, would probably prefer not to go and do, because they have like their trusted crew that they've been working with for years now, you know?
Right, exactly. And
so while as like a band like Jukebox Romantics or Tsunami Bomb, like, dude, we'll just show up and play. Like, you know, we're just like, oh, dude, like we don't have like lights or anything. Like, we'll just do our thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're not bringing like pyro and structures. Like,
right. I mean, we could though. Barry, we could.
I got the sparklers ready.
Let's do it. Yeah. But no.
I got a little tiny Stonehenge ready to go.
Yes. Mm. I love it. Well, hey man, yeah, that's all rad, man. And
but yes, new music in the fall, and then Fest hopefully, and then we'll probably play a few shows like in the tri-state area. Tri-state on the East Coast is like New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. I had to think about it. Yeah. And we'll probably do stuff like that leading up to before then, if it's possible. I don't even know if that's possible. Our band looks at this playing shows right now, we will not play shows unless everybody has had the opportunity to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the way we think about that is like, that means you had your chance, you decided to do it, that's great. You decided not to, that's cool too. But then my conscience is clear about it, like if we're going to play a show and that sort of thing happens. And I mean like the collective, everybody, like everybody's had a chance. In the area where we're playing, or in general, because we waited this long already. Like, why not wait a little bit longer if it means everybody being a little bit safer?
Yeah, at a certain point, something will have to give, you know. And to your point, though, it is an individual's decision.
Sure.
Yeah. To do it, you know, and so I feel like at a certain point we will stop having to police people on it. You know, I think, yeah. I think now it's fine. Like now, like we should be like, no, 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 we're not doing shit until people have an opportunity to get the vaccination.
Sure. Oh yeah.
But after a certain amount of time and people have had the option and we've seen at least maybe like some threshold, you know, of people that have actually gotten a vaccination, then we can proceed and then go forward. Because on the other side of that coin, it's also the like musician or the concert goer's choice to partake in that event,
but
whether or not they've had the vaccination or not.
You know? Well, and, but it also might be up to the venue. I know there's some venues that are talking about like having to prove that you were vaccinated to go, you know? So that's like a whole thing also. But like, I mean, like, I think there's some time still, like, you know, in 2 weeks here in, you know, in New York at the end of April, there is a huge hardcore show happening for free in a park in New York City. And I think that's super cool, but also super irresponsible. Like, I just think it's too soon. I think it's too soon for that. And I just think, and that's my personal opinion. I don't know. Like Hey, Madball and Murphy's Law and Blood Clot are playing at Tompkins Square Park. Like, I love going to shows there growing up, like seeing Leftover Crack there, going to see bands play in the park for free. That sounds awesome. But in fucking April, can we not wait till like August? Like, you know, I mean, do you, if you want to do that. But like, to me, it just seems like why April? Like, why couldn't you just wait a little bit longer? Like, it just seems, you know, it just seems a little much, a little silly. And that's just my opinion. You know, I'm not telling anybody what to do. It's just how I feel on it. And how, as a band, the four of us feel about doing stuff. It's like, if we're going to do something, we want it to be where people feel comfortable enough to enjoy it. Because right now, like, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing something like that. And that's just me. And maybe something would change my mind. If my fucking favorite bands, which is a nice segue, if some of my favorite bands were about to play a show all together, you know, would I do it? I don't know, maybe. Like, I had to ask myself that question a couple of years ago. We were going to see, it was Asbury Park, which is about 2 hours from where we live. Frank Turner was playing outside, and Murder by Death and Against Me were opening up. And Murder by Death and Against Me are two of my favorite bands. And I like Frank Turner too. I was like, this is going to be awesome. Outdoor show, Asbury Park on the beach. Like, it's a no-brainer. It's going to be great. Well, it rained. And so they canceled the show. We were already like on our way down. We're like, fuck, what are we going to do? And then we saw that Against Me and Murder by Death moved the show to Asbury Lanes for $10. But there was a whole dilemma there, because Asbury Lanes recently in the last few years was bought and changed by this evil company that's like ruining Asbury Park. And so many people were like, I'm never going there. I'll never go there. And really didn't. We never played a show there. We were offered to play there. We didn't play there. There was all this shit. And, you know, with my fucking fiance and friends, and we had tickets and we're already on our way down. And it was like, do we go? Do we not go? I'm like, how can we not go? It's like, we're already on our way down. It's $10. Do we really, like, you know, like, we already lost the money from this rain out show. Like, it's, you know, it's this and that. Like, it's rain or shine. It got canceled. Whatever happened. So we did it. And so to backtrack to the pandemic stuff, if five of my favorite bands were going to play outside somewhere, it would be hard for me to say no at this point, you know? So that's kind of, it's kind of, you know, situational.
Yeah. I mean, I think any kind of like absolutes at this point is not worth going down that road. It's going to be a matter of situation and comfort level and you know, how responsibly the venue is being and everything like that.
But, oh yeah. And I think we'll all learn really quick about which venues take things seriously and which ones don't.
Well, Fest is going to be a very big like litmus test for this, because I mean, there's other festivals that are coming down the pike prior to that. Like, I know there's Punk in the Park. There's, you know, I Punk Rock Bowling will be before it. So actually, I mean, there will be a few that'll be prior to that, but you know, within the different, areas. And I mean, the layouts are a little different too. Like, you know, Fest has like a mix of indoor and outdoor, and going same thing. And then there's Punk in the Park, which is like, I think only outdoor. So, you know, I have faith that they'll be able to pull it off safely and do the right thing. I mean, these people have been doing this for a long time. So
I think so. I mean, especially because, like, you know, there's ways to do it safely. I mean,
yeah. A lot of it's going to depend on the individuals going too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, hopefully we just don't, I mean, I don't know, like, I'm going to say this, and I mean, hopefully people don't get, like, too offended, but it's like, if you're going to show up and be an asshole, you better get ready to get the fuck kicked out of you. Like, you know, because no one's going to deal with that shit.
Oh yeah, yeah. People are already so uncomfortable. Like, I know some people who are, like, never going to go to concerts again. Some people, you know, so
yeah. Yeah.
For those of us who need to.
Right.
For our insanity. Like, you know, I don't think anybody wants to be, like, you know, treated poorly.
Right. But yeah, like, segue, as you had mentioned, a couple of things that I like to throw out and ask every guest that I have on the show. First and foremost, who are some artists or bands that you think need to be on people's radar right now?
Sure. I wrote it down because I knew I'd change it 100 times and forget. So let me look. So one band right now is our good friends in the band Oh the Humanity. They are from Massachusetts. They just put out a record on Hell-Minded Records. They are fucking awesome. They are great human beings, which is, like, a major, major thing for me in bands. Like, if I like your band, that's cool. If I find out you're good people, like, that's even cooler. And I know that's hard to say because we live in a world where, like, people suck who create awesome music sometimes, and it's hard to separate the art from the artist. But these people are awesome, and they are really, really good. They've played fest. They tour a little bit, definitely around the Northeast. So check out Oh the Humanity. They're fucking awesome. Another Northeast band from Massachusetts is a band called Denzel, D-N-Z-L. They are a hardcore band, super politically active. They just are awesome. They just have energy. And they have a new record that they are going to put out probably within the next year or so. So Denzel, Oh the Humanity, who else do I have here? Let me look at my list. Those were two. I didn't even look at the list. I tried to do it from my brain. I've been studying real estate stuff like a nerd, so my brain is not working right. Love Breakers and Aerial Salad, two bands from the UK. Love Breakers are awesome. We played with them the last time we were over there. And Aerial Salad, we played at Booze Crew with. And they are funny dudes. They are fucking crazy three-piece, like, huge energy. Great dudes, great band, and they have an awesome story. I think they, like, snuck in to fest and played, and they were underage and they got wasted and got basically banned from fest. And, like,
oh, no.
Their goal is to get back to fest, and they're killing it right now in Europe and the UK, and they're growing really quickly, and they are just awesome. They have just awesome energy. And, like, now I think it's important. And I think, I'll bring it up in one of the next bands that I mentioned. So I'll save it. Playing Dead. They're a band from Long Island. Sam writes the most catchiest songs. If you're a fan of, like, Face to Face and, like, the Get Up Kids, Playing Dead have been writing music all throughout the pandemic and before that, and released so much music that, like, I think that sometimes that's definitely the way of the world right now, is releasing music all the time and not just, like, waiting for, like, record cycles anymore. At least I feel like that's the way things are going. For punk rock and rock and roll, it's a little bit different because I feel like people will always like an album. But in general, they release music all the time, this band Playing Dead, and, like, EPs and full lengths. And check out Playing Dead from Long Island, not the Grateful Dead cover band, but Playing Dead. And then for a band that probably a bunch of listeners know, but maybe if you don't, I think a band that should be on everybody's radar is Red City Radio, because I think that they are just a really great rock and roll band, besides being, like, in the punk rock scene of things. And I think that they have something that I think is missing from a lot of new rock bands, especially punk bands, which is, like, a rock star energy. Like, there is an energy or, like, an it factor that is that necessarily, like, a lot of our bands and our scene and genre, like, dumbs down sometimes. Like, there's a saying, like, there's no room for rock stars in punk rock, and there's, like, everybody should be, like, everyone of the people. And I think that's true. And I think with social media, everybody's become really, like, reachable. And so, like, you know, when you were younger and there was a band that you liked, there was, like, the aura around them. You didn't really know everything about them. You knew their music and you kind of knew, like, something about them if there was like a documentary about the band, but you didn't know them as people. With, I think, social media, there's like a someone that gets stripped down for everybody. And there's like a lot of realism with things, which is great, but like, it's still rock and roll. Like, I like Kiss. I like Meatloaf. I like big bands that have a big vibe. Queen, you know what I'm saying? And there's, I feel like you can have that rock star energy without being a rock star asshole. And sure. I feel like a band like Red City Radio gives out that like big rock and roll vibe and that energy without having that, like, you know, like somebody is like a star or like somebody has like an ego directly like on them. And I think that's tough to give off a rock star energy without having an ego.
Yeah.
So Red City Radio is another band on the radar, and the goddamn Jukebox Romantics. Shameless plug for myself. Why not?
Hey, I can appreciate that. No problem. Yeah. I think more people should just go ahead and shameless plug. I mean, why the fuck not, dude? There's no rules.
You know? I mean, isn't that why we're here?
Yeah.
It's fine.
That's why I do this. So I can just plug everything that I do.
You know? Yeah. I mean, I think. Yeah. And that goes back to what I'm saying about like in our scene specifically, there's like this built-in thing for years of like not selling out or not doing something, which is like such a weird thing.
Blah blah blah.
Because wouldn't you want the bands that you like to be somewhat can make money off of what they're doing? But you should be proud of what you do. You know, you should be stoked on what you're doing. And us, everybody should know who we are. and be on their radar.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Like, people should be listening to Jukebox Romantics. I mean, you guys are great. You write really good songs. They're catchy. They're fun. You guys have a great energy. I love watching you guys play live. Playing Dead, hard second. Like, Sam's a great songwriter. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lovebreakers, I've been really digging what they're doing. I know that they're working with Rob and Wiretap. I know of Ariel Salad from the guys in Decent Criminal, actually. Like, they speak really highly of them. Apparently, they were supposed to do some touring with them.
Oh, okay.
It got canceled because of the pandemic. So I think that they just postponed it. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that they could do it later.
Yeah, I felt like there was like a surge happening with Ariel Salad. Like, they were just starting to do a lot of cool things. And
right.
I felt like a good stuff coming from them.
Nice. But I'll check out those other bands too. But yeah, man, last question really I have for you. I know that this is like a ridiculous question, but I love asking it. If you only had 5 records to pick to listen to on a desert island or something like that for the rest of your life, what would they be?
Ooh, this was tough. And I wrote it down specifically because I knew I would change it like 100 times. Sure. I almost put on a record that I'm not I'm a fan of, but I only was going to put it on because it's a long record. So I was like, oh, if I'm stuck on an island, wouldn't you want a record that's really long? Mm-hmm. So my honorable mention that didn't make my list is And Out Come the Wolves.
Okay.
Because it's a great record, but it's also like forever long. Like, I feel like it's like 27 songs and it's like 4 hours long. It's not, but that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
To me, in my brain. So I have Blink-182 Dude Ranch, which maybe is my favorite record from them. Maybe not their best record, but it's also one of their longer records. And I feel like Mark Hoppus actually sounded good on that record vocally and playing bass. Same thing with Tom DeLonge. I feel like his guitar playing has always been good. And I feel like he is not looked at as like a great guitar player. But I feel like on that record, he was still bringing it for what they do. So Dude Ranch, because like it's basically the one of the bands of why I play music is Blink-182. I then have Postal Service's one record, which is called Give Up. I am not a fan of Death Cab for Cutie. I'm not a fan of Rilo Kiley, but I love the Postal Service, which is basically just those two bands put together. Mm-hmm. I think that album is perfect. For anybody who doesn't know who the Postal Service is, they are a side project. They put out one record. It went platinum and gold a couple times or whatever. And then they played like 3 shows and then never played again. And then 10 years after the record, they realized that they had a huge fan base and they played like 2 shows in LA, 2 shows in Chicago, and 2 shows in New York. And I went to the New York show and I got really, really high and I cried like half the time. it was awesome. So the Postal Service Give Up record, because it's the perfect vibe song for anything. If you're in a good mood, stuck on an island, it's a great record. If you're in a terrible mood, it's probably a great record too.
Oh, dude, that record is timeless. It's fantastic. Oh, yeah.
I think it's perfect. I then have Alkaline Trio from Here to Infirmary. Nice. Alkaline Trio is one of those bands that like is another one of those bands of why I'm in a band. And I've seen them a ton and I love that record. That was the first record that I got from them. Maybe not my favorite, maybe not their best, but I think because it's the first one that I had from them, it's what got me into them. And a lot of friends of mine, I guess in the same age range, who got into Alkaline Trio in 2001, when finding more obscure punk bands, that was the record. And then we went back and got God Damn It and Maybe I'll Catch Fire and all that stuff. And I think From Here Infirmary has some of their best songs. Mm-hmm. Maybe not even my favorite. I just think because it's the first one I heard, there's a nostalgia factor there. And if I'm stuck on an island, I'd like to think about good memories. And I think that's the one that will bring me to good memories. So that's why I picked that one.
Yeah.
Side note, shameless plug. Jukebox Romantics did a secret Alkaline Trio set at Booze Cruise and Pooza a few years ago. And there's videos of it on YouTube somewhere. So check it out if you like Alkaline Trio and you like us. Let's see. Bouncing Souls, Anchors Away. Again, I think Anchors Away is the best Bouncing Souls record. I've had this argument with people a ton. There's like an argument with Bouncing Souls fans or people who are into that band. I think their most popular record is How I Spent My Summer Vacation. True Believers is on there. It's a great record. It's probably one of their best records, but I think Anchors Away is their best songs and best songwriting. Hopeless Romantic is my favorite Bouncing Souls record, but I picked Anchors Away because it's the longest. And so if I'm going to be stuck on an island and I need a long record and I need a Bouncing Souls record, that's the one I picked. It's long. There's a secret track. Why not? And then my last record is, One Man Army's Rumors and Headlines. I love One Man Army, and I think this record is perfect. Also, I also am not sick of it, whereas like a lot of my favorite records, I played a lot growing up, and then when the digital age came, I had it on Spotify or iTunes or whatever. One Man Army's music is not really on Spotify. They just have like one EP, and so I have this record on vinyl. I don't have it on my phone, so I feel like if I was going to get stuck on an island, I guess it was, it's a favorite record that I haven't heard a lot. So I figured One Man Army's, you know, Rumors and Headlines, because it's so good. And I love Dead to Me, and I love everything Jack does. I think he is like one of the best vocalists in punk rock and a great songwriter. And I think he'll be remembered years from now. And I think now I think he's very unique for our genre. And I don't know if people look at him and his songs and his voice the way I do, but I feel like there's something really unique about what he does and the songs that he writes. But yeah, because I don't know anybody's voice who sounds like his. You know, there's a lot of people that sound like Fat Mike and Tom DeLonge, but there's not a lot of people that sound like Jack Dalrymple.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I've had the pleasure of meeting Jack a couple times. He's a really, really nice guy, first of all. And I actually totally agree with you. Like, he's an excellent songwriter. Everything he's been involved with has been freaking awesome. Like Toy Guitar, Dead to Me, Swing and Nutters, One Man Army. I mean,
yeah, Revolts. I think he was doing that for a little bit, maybe.
I can't remember if he was in that or not, but I mean, you know, he caught the ear of like, you know, Green Day, did like Seth Through Adeline Records. He's obviously like caught the ear.
So recently I got Dead End Stories, which is One Man Army's first record. And I had no idea that it was produced by Billy Joe. Billy Joe Armstrong produced that record, but it's not on Adeline. And then the next record was on Adeline, but Billy Joe didn't produce it. Yeah. And I think that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, that's a testament. It's like, you know, clearly the guy, you know, has a knack for writing good stuff and like catching the attention of people that can help propel him and whatnot. And he's, you know, he's a great guitar player, great singer. Yeah. Great performer. Do you have the One Man Army and Alkaline Trio split?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a great
record. And that's a great record too. And I think that's like, I feel like that's like the heyday of split records. Like shit, like everything.
That whole BYO series.
The BYO series is gold. Yeah. I remember just like arguing like in the car all the time, driving around, listening to the NoFX Rancid split and arguing who did what side better. Because I had so many friends who were big Rancid fans and I was just like, NoFX did everything better. And they were like, no, Rancid did everything better. And like, I think that's fun because now, like, I feel like splits happen because bands want to do splits with each other. And maybe because I'm in a band, that's how I think of it now. But like being just a music fan, starting playing in bands at the time, like I thought splits were like the coolest idea ever. And I think it's because there wasn't really the internet. Like, so it was like a cool like idea, like, oh, you get half of a record from one band and half of a record from another band.
Right.
Whereas now with a split, it's like, oh, cool. Like the same idea that happens, but like, I could just go on the internet and listen to the song. So it's
right.
There's something a little bit different about the idea. Yeah. I love splits. I just think it's one of those things. Like I remember Matt Skiba and Kevin Seconds did a split. And I remember I never listened to the Kevin Seconds song because I hated it all. It's like, oh, the Matt Skiba sign is gold. And I don't know anybody who liked the Kevin Seconds sign. I'm sure it's great if somebody does, but I never liked it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he's like a legendary person in punk, you know? So, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people listening to that side of the record that you don't have to, and it's fine.
I know. I'm sure there's somebody who listens to that song and doesn't listen to Matt Skiba.
Well, right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure. Yeah. For every person that says like, I don't listen to Kevin Seconds, I'm sure there'd be, yeah, exactly.
Same. I just think it's funny. Cause I was just like, but that's split records. We did a split a couple years ago with the Sewer Rats, and that was super fun. And this is fun to do it with your band friends, you know? And do stuff like that. I don't think anybody ever does a split with people that they don't like. Has there ever been a split with people?
I mean, you'd hope so. Like,
right?
Yeah. Instead of like,
I would love to see a split.
Instead of a couple bands like hate fucking each other on each other's side, you know, it's like.
Oh, I would love to see a split that was like East Coast, West Coast rap split, or like a Slipknot and Britney Spears split, like something so ridiculous.
Them covering each other.
Oh my God. Can you imagine Britney Spears playing like Hate, like Wait and Bleed, and like Slipknot doing like Toxic? Dude, if Slipknot did Toxic by Britney Spears,
they could fucking insane. They could pull off Toxic. I don't think that Britney Spears could pull off Slipknot.
Ooh,
but then again,
I would challenge
probably that. Surprise me, you know? Yeah. Who knows, dude? I mean, she's got a ton of people working with her. She's clearly talented, you know?
Oh, but, yeah. I think she could pull it off.
Yeah, she probably could.
I'm going to make this happen. Let me make this happen.
Emails my agent. Mike, it's been a pleasure talking to you, man. Like I'm always stoked to talk to you, and I'm glad that things are rolling together for you.
Oh yeah.
Glad you got vaccinated. I got my first shot the other day, so my arm's real sore.
Nice.
Yeah. Trying to move it around. Yeah, man. Gearing up for what's coming.
Which microchip gang are you buying?
House Moderna.
Oh yeah. Nice. Yeah. House Pfizer. Moderna.
Oh, House Pfizer. Nice.
Okay. Yeah, well, now we have to rumble.
All right, brother. Well, good to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on the nuptials and the fatherhood and the pending home ownership.
Ugh.
You're an adult. Face it.
No, I'd rather be called an adult than a grown up. So I'll take it.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks.
I'm so fucking tired!